The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, that's good to practice with you. In some ways, the topic feels not so well timed. Other ways, feels right too. Specifically in the sense of not to be reductionistic and diagnose all kind of political, socio-political derangement as a kind of spiritual problem, but the topic of self is relevant in what we're perceiving. We kind of see the kind of egoic forces are just wedded to greed and delusion. So a few words on this. So the Buddha said that to study the Dharma is to study causality. And of course, most interested in what causes and conditions tend towards suffering, what causes and conditions tend towards peace, considered the highest happiness. And there's a kind of saying, that correlation does not imply causation. If you know statistics or, quantitative stuff, you're familiar with that. Correlation does not imply causation. Correlation means two things are related. Knowing about one gives you information about the other. Knowing how many, just for example, knowing how many cigarettes I smoke, you know something about my disease risk, right? Correlated. And two things can be correlated, but not have a causal relationship. So people who wear bow ties might have higher rate, and you made this up. People who wear bow ties might have higher rates of vitamin D deficiency, for example. But that doesn't mean that tie wearing causes the deficiency. Maybe the people who wear bow ties are more likely to be inside more, work inside, have less sun exposure, right? It's not causal. Causality entails something more, correlation. And you have to rule out, for one, reverse causality, right? So, okay, maybe there's a presumption smoking causes disease, but maybe the presence of disease makes people more likely to smoke, for example. That's the case, actually, in some disease. Reverse causality. So we have to understand what's the nature between cause and effect. Why? Matthew, why are you talking about this? I've had some ongoing questions in my head and discussions with others about the relationship between the insight into self, anatta, and freedom. What's the relationship between that insight and freedom? Does the insight, we could say, have causal efficacy? Does having that insight cause freedom? And sometimes it's claimed that, indeed, insight into anatta causes a change in the experience of one's life, one's level of freedom. I think that's true in many cases. You're grappling with something, maybe subtly, maybe desperately grappling with something, And it's really hard to track, hard to know how personal it all has become. And by personal, where it becomes very personal, what I mean is how deeply that experience, feeling, what story, whatever, how deeply it's a commentary on who you are. I mean, how isolated and isolating the experience is, taking something personally, personalizing loneliness and alienation, the kind of facet of egoic life, that disjointedness, it's a facet of egoic life. There's shame often when we're taking something personally. It's the potential for shame. Shame is the underbelly of self. By personally, I mean how kind of narrow it can get, how mesmerized we are by the narrative of my life, birth, life, death. By personally, I mean how obscured the kind of vastness of space, of time, of Dhamma becomes. And then the fever breaks. The agitation dissolves. The sense that all experience refers back to me also dissolves. And just a completely phenomena just become completely unthreatening ebb and flow of nature, as someone said, arising, passing. And the effect of that is a reduction or the vanishing of suffering. There seems to be a causal relationship. The insight catalyzes freedom. Okay, fair enough. But more often, I feel like anatta and freedom are correlated, not causal, not in a causal relationship. That sometimes anatta is not the cause of freedom, but the holistic effect of our path. That our growing freedom unfolds the understanding of not self. We understand anatta through many mechanisms, not simply those kind of very punctuated experiences, insights into the emptiness of self. There are many forces on the path that lead us in this direction. And so the Dharma functions as a kind of a de encourages a kind of decentering of the self. All the ideas, the Dharma, as I've talked about at times, Dharma as a cognitive therapy, what views to pick up, what ideas to believe. And it really begins with a kind of de-centering of self. And dukkha, suffering, becomes profoundly impersonal. The first noble truth that there is dukkha, that it's woven into the fabric of existence, that imperfection is not a problem to be solved, that you did not create this law, that it isn't your failing. This is a kind of decentering effect. And goodness, likewise, becomes impersonal. You know, you're when we touch into goodness, it reveals, it is revealed amidst our utter ordinariness, not our specialness. Our sila, our ethical conduct, moves us against the intoxication of self. And just developing this ethical sensitivity, it's easy to move through life without recognizing how deeply we assume others are features within our life rather than their own unique expression of consciousness. We recognize that we are as much an object in their mind as they are in ours. And someone joked that, in traffic jam on the Bay Bridge or something, like rather than like, and it's always, if you don't live here, if you don't drive, it's bad, and it's like rather than looking forward to all the cars and saying, what are these people doing in my way? The task is to gaze backwards and wonder, look at all the people I'm blocking, right? Love is the dramatization of the subjectivity of the other, the dramatization of their subjectivity. As the world gets larger, the self gets smaller. And the degree to which we center, privilege our own well-being over that of others starts to shrink, maybe just a little, starts to shrink. We get other tastes of anatta in the kind of the humility engendered by this path. It is a humbling path. We get to see the limitations of our willfulness. And if we're practicing sincerely, our grandiosity just is absolutely pommeled by this path. We cannot sit still for 5 minutes and conclude, I've really got my shit together. 5 minutes is enough to dispel that, Okay, starting to, yeah, self softening, softening. We see how compulsivity animates our life, how okay, you need to let go and cannot. And when we witness that, we start to develop some compassion ourselves for others. How locked in we are with those grooves of habit energies where it seems like no overriding the tide of delusion. And amidst that helplessness, we come to appreciate conditionality more deeply. And all the psychological healing that happens on the path is a kind of gradual disidentification and loosening the self story. The healing that we do on this path, the effect is, even if the self is not the target, the effect of all of the healing is a softening, a kind of fluidification, the sense of self. And so the case I'm making is like so many aspects of this path lead us into more fluid sense of self. And that's why I get a little hesitant when the approach is kind of anatta or bust, gonna see this or not, it's like it's now or never, that kind of sense. And not only does that put pressure on the self to make not self happen, but there's something about the causal assumptions are confused. And so the path really it works holistically. And sometimes you see examples through meditation, sometimes through drugs or extreme endurance, exertion, something. People have a kind of experience of anatta, but it doesn't always lead anywhere. An experience is not a path, as Joseph Goldstein said. And so the path works holistically to move us towards anatta, move us in that direction. Anatta is a cause of freedom, but also an effect too. Offer this for your consideration. Let's practice well this week. Take good care of yourself, each other, and be back next week. Okay.